This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, we're still on the airwaves, so the radio station fundraising campaign must have been successful.
It was. But you know, community radio is always on life support, so please don't wait for the next fundraising campaign. Get in the spirit of the season and send a contribution. You can do it online at WESUFM.org.
Speaking of life support, the health reform bill is in need of some resuscitation, and President Obama called all 60 members of the Democratic caucus to the White House yesterday for a pep talk as the tentative outline of the health reform package started to break down over this last weekend.
It became clear that there were troubles when Connecticut's junior senator Joe Lieberman backed away from his earlier willingness to support the Medicare expansion proposal that just last week seemed to seal the deal. I think the progressives must feel like they've been mugged, as the bill that's shaping up omits two key provisions, a government-run public option insurance plan and the expansion of Medicare.
That Medicare expansion would have covered several million uninsured people ages 55 to 64. These quick turns of events are fraying a lot of nerves.
I think President Obama realizes this, and he's pushing very hard because while it's true that the senators are getting a little frazzled, I think the general public's mood is shifting too. He really needs to address the country's concern about jobs, and that's going to take the oxygen out of the healthcare debate. Timing is just so critical right now.
They need some oxygen in the Senate as they've been on a marathon, meeting in session for 14 consecutive days. I'm not sure they have the energy to wrap this up by Christmas. The president is going to put coal in their stocking if they don't get a version out and over to the House, where they still have to reconcile the two different bills.
Well, nobody wants to get coal in their stocking this time of year, especially with this administration's focus on controlling global warming. Conversations will keep you informed on all the latest climate changes in every way as they occur.
This week's Conversation on Healthcare interview is with Dr. Peter Pronovost, Medical Director of Johns Hopkins Center for Innovation in Quality Patient Care. Dr. Pronovost is internationally recognized for his work on how to improve patient safety and quality.
Dr. Pronovost's work was the focus of an article in The New Yorker by Atul Gawande. He said, Pronovost's work has already saved more lives than that of any laboratory scientist in the past decade.
No matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. You can now subscribe to iTunes to get our show regularly downloaded. Or if you'd like to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of one of our shows, come visit us at chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at conversations@chc1.com. We love to hear from you. Today, Conversations looks at perhaps the most important innovation of all, the ones that save lives, reduce suffering, and yes, they even save money in the process. They are not necessarily the most expensive. They aren't blockbuster drugs or biomedical devices. These innovations may be the most challenging, though, because they call upon all of us in healthcare, doctors, nurses, administrators, to change our own behavior and our culture in pursuit of safety and quality. Our guest today is Dr. Peter Pronovost, Medical Director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Innovation and Quality Patient Care. A practicing anesthesiologist and critical care physician, he holds appointments in both the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and its Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Pronovost's research, which has focused on how to improve patient safety and quality in the ICU setting, is characterized by a blend of methodological sophistication and practical attention to the details of making change happen and making it stick. One example of his work is his now famous checklist, which has been written about in The New Yorker and even put him on Time's list of most influential people in America. Borrowing from the aviation industry, he pioneered the use of a checklist in ICU that converted hundreds of pages of evidence-based guidelines to a simple 5-point checklist for use by doctors and nurses at the bedside. It has been shown to reduce infection and save lives. His research at the bedside and on the units acknowledges that while health reform legislation may start at the top, transforming care always starts with the care of the patients and the people who provide it. He speaks to the importance of creating a culture of safety, one in which the newest nurse can stop the most senior surgeon from proceeding if that surgeon hasn't washed his or her hands. Dr. Pronovost is far from alone in this work. Across the country, the past 10 years has seen an unprecedented focus on patient safety. The Institute of Healthcare Improvement, founded by Dr. Don Berwick in 1991, is devoted to transforming healthcare and, in particular, to improving quality and reducing medical error. Their 100,000 Lives campaign just a few years ago brought the country's attention to the fact that medical errors kill and they aren't rare. Dr. Berwick says, "The names of the patients whose lives we save will never be known. Our contribution will be what did not happen to them. And though they are unknown, we will know that mothers and fathers are at graduations and weddings they would have missed, that grandchildren will know grandparents they might never have known. Holidays will be taken, work completed, books read, symphonies heard, and gardens tended that, without our work, would never have been." Both Dr. Berwick and Dr. Pronovost are clear. We need to be very specific in collecting and reporting data on healthcare quality and safety and on setting goals to improve care. Dr. Berwick, in setting his goal of preventing 100,000 deaths from medical error, spoke to the urgency of the matter, saying, "Soon is not a date and some is not a number." Dr. Pronovost advises hospitals and medical centers that the most important step is not to implement his checklist. It's to know their data, know their infection rates, so they can do something about it. As Conversations looks at innovation in healthcare, we are reminded of the Institute of Medicine statement in 2001, that between the healthcare we have and the care we could have lies not just a gap, but a chasm. We still do not reliably transfer science and best-known practice into action, and our processes too frequently fail despite our best intentions.
Dr. Pronovost, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare. Thank you for speaking with us. We understand that you aren't in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins, but rather in England. Can we start by asking you what brings you there today?
Yep, I combined two meetings. One this morning was with WHO to talk about putting this in globally, and I oversee their evaluation for their safety efforts. So how do they know if they're working? And then now in about a half hour, all of the hospitals in the UK are coming together because we're putting our program in England. And you know, it was classic. We came over here with their health authority who said put it in, and all the doctors said, "Oh, we're using your checklist." And I said, "Okay, great. What are your infection rates?" And they said, "Well, we don't know. We don't measure them." And I said, "Well, I don't think that answer is going to cut it for the public. You know, as you know, these are big issues with the public. They're quite fearful of infections. Why don't we agree to go measure and see if you have a problem or not? You know, the public doesn't care if you use my checklist. They want to know, are you going to infect them?" And sure enough, they came back and said, "Okay, our infection rates are quite high. Indeed, they're about what you were at Michigan before you did your project." And I said, "Okay, that's great. Then let's put our program in." So we're here now to do the official launch tonight.
You're a physician who specializes in intensive care at one of the country's most well-known hospitals, Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. When people think about ICU, they think technology, machines, monitors, life-saving devices. But you've become famous for something decidedly low-tech, a paper and pencil checklist. So tell us, if you will, about the checklist that's proven to save thousands of lives and hundreds of millions of dollars. What is it? What inspired it?
Sure. Well, we realized that, and certainly in the intensive care unit, we need those technologies. But when I looked at where patients were being harmed, it was from our failure to do the basic things. And that is often, indeed, about half of the patients will have these catheters that go in the large veins in their neck, that allow us to give medicines to patients or to monitor their heart. And most of the time, indeed, only 30% of the time, we never use the evidence that we know we could do to prevent these infections. And nationally, up to 60,000 people die from infections from these catheters each year. And the guidelines that exist to guide clinicians to use them are elegant and scholarly, but they're nearly 200 pages long, and nobody uses them. So one of the ahas we had, and it came from aviation, to say, "Well, why don't I go simplify that guideline, that 200 pages, and call out into a checklist what things are most important?" And we ended up with a 5-item checklist that was simple, that was robust, and it got dramatic results.
Doctor, you talk about building a culture of safety, training, monitoring, measuring, and reporting. How do you create a culture of safety? How do you get people to change? In addition, perhaps more importantly, how do you get people to admit their mistakes so they can be studied and learned from?
Those are amazing questions. And what we see is that in order to make progress on any problem, whether it's a personal problem, perhaps with substance abuse, or an organizational problem, you have to be humble enough to admit you're fallible. And physicians in particular, but often nurses too, get a culture to believe they're perfect, that doctors don't make mistakes, that I'm held up to this high level. And until you free up the ability to say, you know, I'm going to forget sometime, I'm going to do something wrong, and therefore I need some aids to help me, you'll never get off the dime. But it was so telling about our work with Checklist is I will speak to hospitals, and they'll say, oh, yes, yes, Peter, I'm using your checklist. And I would say, oh, okay, great, but a couple of quick things. One, what are your infection rates? You know, the public doesn't care about if you're using the checklist rate. They want to know if you're going to be infected, and their rates are high. Or two, I would say, okay, now, if the newest nurse were to ask the senior-most physician to go back and wash their hands or to comply with some item on the checklist, would that senior physician obey? And as you could imagine, in virtually every hospital, the answer is, are you nuts? Of course not. And I say, then you don't have the kind of culture that we need in healthcare, that one that's not hierarchical, a culture that's collaborative, a culture that's based on teamwork. And so a big part of our program, indeed probably the biggest legacy, is to create that culture where that nurse is comfortable speaking up and that doctor will listen. And what we've seen is that when you create that culture around one particular behavior, that is, we create a safe space for nurses to speak up or for doctors and nurses to work as a team, it then allows people to spill over that behavior in a variety of other areas and really change the culture in kind of a snowball way.
So, Dr. Pranavas, let's go back to that example you used of the central venous catheters and 60,000 lives lost from infections. Your checklist was shown just looking at that one issue, bloodstream infections in ICU in Michigan, I believe it was, over an 18-month period to save 1,500 lives and I think close to $200 million. You know, we would consider that certainly breakthrough information. I guess the question we're left is, why isn't that mandatory then everywhere that a checklist be used in the ICU? Why hasn't it just become an absolute part of the standard of care, or has it?
No, well, we're working on it now, but I that frustration has been haunting me, because if there was a drug or a device that eliminated an infection that kills 60,000 people a year and it saves $200 million or, you know, in one state, you can be rest assured that it would be produced and it would be in every place in the country. The problem is that it wasn't a device that we did. It was a safety program, and there was no expensive technology. It was a checklist and a culture change program. And most importantly, because most of these deaths are invisible. Like, if you look at the hospital you're going into, I doubt that you know what its infection rates are. And many of the clinicians just chalk up those infections as the cost of doing business, or they say they're inevitable. Patients get sick because they're old or they're very young, or they had a big operation, and we know now that that's not so. So what I think we ought to be doing is mandating that hospitals monitor and report these infections rates, and then let science and innovators come and say how to get them as low as they can go. I don't know that regulation would be helpful to require the use of the specific checklist, because medicine changes quickly, and regulation is often too slow and too blunt of an instrument to really allow modification. But in this case, we could require that you know your infection rate, so hospitals monitor and report them, and then they'd have some incentives to drive down those rates.
You know, I was reading in the New York Times an article about your work, and it said that everybody who was going to be hospitalized or had a relative to be hospitalized should know about your five-point checklist. How do we get that word out? And I'm wondering if it's not like episodes of ER, and I noticed on one episode when one of the physicians was in the OR at the beginning of the case, he pulled out a paper from his scrubs and said, wait, we're going to have to go through this checklist first. Are you seeing that type of popular media adaptation as the way to go versus regulation?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the things that you make, that I speak about all the time is that healthcare has what I would call a very inefficient knowledge market. You know, there's the debate about whether the stock market's efficient or inefficient. In other words, is all the information known? And healthcare is grossly inefficient. We know a whole bunch of things that can keep people happy, that can save lives, that we just don't do very often. And what we need is mechanisms to make this knowledge market more efficient. And I believe deeply that these checklists do what I call democratize knowledge. You know, far too often physicians hide behind fancy words and these long terms that limits the consumer's or the patient's ability to ensure that they're getting what the evidence is. But in this case, we took fancy words and made it five simple things. Wash your hands, clean your skin with the soap called chlorhexidine, avoid the femoral site, use full barrier precautions, and ask every day if I need a catheter. And by putting it in plain, unambiguous language, we now have a way that consumers could share this and I hope walk into hospitals and say, hey, are you using this? And if you're not, why not? And by the way, what are your infection rates? So that we could create this knowledge market where consumers have a huge role in helping make sure that they get the right care that they deserve.
And Dr. Pronovost, as an intensivist and an anesthesiologist as well, right? You work in hospitals with the sickest of people. We're somewhat on the other end of the spectrum. In the primary care community health center world, we see people hopefully earlier in the course of their health problems. We work on prevention always, but also really improving the control and outcome of the chronic diseases, diabetes, asthma, and heart disease. We're curious whether you have any thoughts on how your work applies in the primary care setting. Have you thought about that at all?
Sure, absolutely. And we're working with our primary care colleagues to do that. There's pretty good evidence that on average, for almost any condition you could think of, the likelihood that you or your loved one gets what the evidence says you should get is a coin toss. It's 50%. That includes at some of America's best hospitals and includes some of America's worst hospitals. The numbers are even lower. And part of the reason is there's ambiguity about what to do. You know, we're drowning in a sea of guidelines and conflicting studies. And we haven't taken a step back to simplify, okay, what are the key elements? I can't do 80 things on a 100-page guideline, or I can't do 150 things, but I could maybe do 7. That's why my telephone number is 7 digits. And so we're working with our colleagues in primary care to call out, when you show up with diabetes, what's most critical that you that the care you get, and how do we then feed that back to clinicians so they can get it? We also, in our model, and it's really key, approach this with the mental model that doctors and nurses want to give the right care. And if they don't, there's a barrier. That, you know, so often we go into this judging where if only the doctors would do this, or if only the nurses would do this, or if only administrators would do this, and it's not helpful. Every doctor or nurse I've seen uniformly wants to give the right care. And when they can't, there's typically some barrier. There may be a knowledge deficit. They may not agree with the evidence, so we may need a discussion. There may not be the supplies available. So part of what we do is once we clarify what the behavioral expectations are, what the checklist should be, we then literally go through with them and say, okay, now what's keeping you from doing it? I trust you want to do the right thing. Why is it hard? Let me understand your world, and then we could remove some of those barriers, or you can remove the barriers yourself, so that you make sure every patient all the time gets the evidence they're supposed to.
Conversations focuses on health reform, innovation, and transformation. Cost is a big factor in the healthcare debate. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, can't score a factor in the potential savings to the system if we implemented some of the safety and quality forms that you advocate. How much of a fiscal impact do you think we could make through reducing medical errors and complications like the ones you've just described?
Yeah, I mean, there's it's probably in the $60 to $80 billion range. It's enormous. I mean, I'll give you just one example. The catheter infections that we virtually eliminated in Michigan cost the country about $2 to $3 billion. There's great data that says complications double or in many cases triple your average cost of care. So you take, you know, your average hospital stay, and if I have any of these complications, I often stay twice or three times as long, and it costs me two or three times more money. Mm-hmm. And we overtest. That is, we, because of financial incentives and some uncertainty, we order tests that patients don't need. And so you put that together and you have an enormous ability that there's essentially money being thrown away that mm-hmm. not only will it save money, but it's better quality care. And we need to tap into that, because as we need to expand insurance to those 47 million people who lack it, and I believe strongly that it's deplorable that a country as wealthy as ours doesn't provide insurance to its citizens, we also have to be fiscally responsible and say, how are we going to pay for that? Well, we have to start mm-hmm. getting rid of this waste that we spend every day by hurting people and doing things that they don't really benefit from.
Dr. Pronovost, you're a tremendous innovator, and we know that you've got your eye on the country and the world. What do you see in health innovations that excites you, and who should we be looking at?
Yeah, I think there's a whole bunch of innovations that are going on. In the field of biomedical research, you're going to see a lot more tests for diagnostic things. So based on blood tests or what are called biomarkers, looking at either people who are at risk for cancers or infections. And so I think you're going to see a lot of innovation there.
Dr. Pronovost, we want to thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare. Thanks for the terrific work, and we look forward to speaking to you again in the future.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea focuses on community bike sharing programs, which both improve physical fitness and reduce harmful air pollution. One such program began at the University of California at Berkeley in August of 2008, a product of the Bright Ideas at Berkeley contest. The Green Bike Share Project aims to reduce student car use and improve student wellness by providing a healthy transportation alternative. Students pay a per semester fee of just $15 and can check out a bike for up to 24 hours, allowing them ample time to travel through campus and around city without having to drive. The program staff handles all maintenance and repairs, and bike stations are strategically located in high traffic areas to increase student access. The Green Bike Share Project, health, environment, and benefits abound. By increased transportation-based activity or incidental exercise, the program helps students easily integrate regular exercise into their daily lives. And by reducing local greenhouse gas emissions, it also cuts down on air pollution and the resulting public health problems like asthma and cardiovascular disease. The program is also uniting the UC Berkeley community in a broader effort to become more environmentally sustainable. Justin Wiley, the UC Berkeley student who created the program, describes his hope for the Green Bike Share, saying, "This is the beginning of something great. We are seeing bike share programs slowly starting to pop up around America, and we truly believe it's one answer to reducing our carbon footprint and getting our country into shape." As Wiley points out, other bike-sharing programs have been implemented with similar success across the country and around the world in places like Amsterdam, Brussels, Copenhagen, Seattle, Portland, and New York. In fact, Paris's bike-share program has already made over 10,000 bikes available at 750 stations in the metropolitan area. Bike-sharing programs like these are becoming increasingly popular and important as global consciousness about the dangers of greenhouse gas emissions grows, and people begin looking for solutions to combat this problem in everyday lives. Riding a bike to work or school instead of driving a car is a great way for ordinary individuals to do their part while also bettering their health. Improving your physical fitness and reducing your carbon footprint, now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.